you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
It's NPR News.
Live from LAist 89.3, I'm Suzanne Whatley. It's 9:04. In local news, still recovering from the time change on Sunday, there is a way that California can keep from having to move clocks back and forth an hour. Voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 7 back in 2018. It was supposed to keep us from having to adjust our clocks twice a year. So why did we still have to spring forward this past Sunday? Reporter Olivia Zhao explains.
When the measure passed, it allowed the legislature to change daylight saving time either by establishing it year-round or abolishing it. But California lawmakers still can't agree which approach they want to support. Health experts at Johns Hopkins have warned about the potential health risks of switching back and forth. And there could be new hope. Just this year, Roseville Senator Roger Nilo introduced a bill to abolish daylight saving time for good and establish standard time year-round.
Olivia reports for CalMatters. The 96th Academy Awards drew its biggest audience in 4 years on Sunday. About 19.5 million people tuned in to watch Hollywood's biggest night on ABC. That's up 4% from last year's 18.7 million. Viewership reportedly peaked in the final half hour of the show, which included Ryan Gosling's performance of I'm Just Ken from Barbie. The show started an hour early this year to draw more East Coast viewers, but it's not clear if that affected the numbers. And Al Pacino might have seemed like he was supposed to read all the names of the Oscar Best Picture nominees before his rather anticlimactic announcement of Oppenheimer as the winner, but the actor has issued a statement saying that it was a choice made by the producers, since the nominees had been highlighted earlier in the show. For local news anytime, go to laist.com. It's 9:06.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross in for Larry Mantle today. So nice to be with you on this Tuesday. We have a lot of fun stuff to talk about today. Also, a lot of important things. We're going to talk about police departments using what's known as less lethal weapons. We're also going to look at how our relationship with jewelry has changed. A lot of younger folks are maybe losing interest in the fancier pieces, but I also want to hear from you about jewelry you've inherited. Maybe what's special about it to you. We're going to talk about that later. But as you heard from this music, yeah, we got to talk Disney. Take a trip down to Anaheim, where Disney's park expansion proposal, known as Disney Forward, cleared its first hurdle. Joining me to discuss is our own Yusra Farzan, reporter for LAist. Welcome to you, Yusra.
Hi, Austin.
We also have with us Robert Niles, editor of news site ThemeParkInsider.com. Robert, thank you to you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Well, Yusra, just to start us off, the Anaheim Planning Commission, they voted to relax some zoning rules last night. Can you tell us what the Disneyland Forward project is and kind of what was being proposed there?
Yeah, Austin. So it's a $1.9 billion expansion. But what this means is it's not that Disneyland is expanding into the city of Anaheim. Rather, development is going to shift across Disney properties. So we're going to see more theme parks, more restaurants, more hotels, but just within Disney properties. The only thing that is going to change is Disney has asked for more space for 4,300 employee spacers. So it does not increase the permitted square footage. Instead, right now, you know, when you go down to downtown Disney, you have the hotels in one area, the restaurants in one area, the theme parks in one area. So instead, it's going to become mixed use. So you'll sort of see, hotels and theme parks all together almost. It does not require public funding. So the $1.9 billion is going to come from Disney, and this expansion is going to be across 10 years. But one thing that is interesting, and it was not discussed at the Planning Commission meeting yesterday, but it was discussed at the last City Council meeting, and the City Council is going to be having a public hearing next month. As part of this proposal, Disney is looking to buy three public streets, including Magic Way Yeah, and it did come up at the Planning Commission meeting just because a lot of residents are invested in this. Around 15,000 people use those streets. So the City Council is looking to hear from the public next month, in a public hearing before they decide whether to sell these streets to Disneyland.
Talking right now with Yusra Farzana, a reporter for LAS, who's covering Disney and their latest clearing of a major hurdle in their plans to reimagine a space that they already have. So they're also looking to take on some streets in this, Yusra, which is really fascinating. At the meeting last night, we heard from a lot of residents. Some were in favor of this project, some weren't. What were some of the thoughts that we heard?
Yeah, so we had some people who said that, who spoke in favor of it. They said that, Disney is one of the biggest employers in the city, and this development would bring in more jobs, to the city. So people were in favor of that. But then there were others who said that, the city is sort of giving Disney leeway. Their magic, like, for example, the sale of their public streets. They say that it's only Disney studies that the city is considering and that the city should be doing their own studies. They've also expressed concerns about things like what this would mean for traffic concerns and noise for people who live in the area, all these expansion efforts.
Talking right now with Yusra Farzan, let's go to Robert Niles, editor of news site ThemeParkInsider.com. Robert, this took 3 years of analysis on the part of the Planning Commission. Was last night's decision expected? Was it a foregone conclusion, or was there some chance they might have said no at some point?
Well, I don't think anything in politics is a foregone conclusion anymore. But Disney certainly has learned from its past recent experiences with Anaheim. If you remember back a few years, the old Eastern Gateway proposal, where Disney kind of figuratively burned a lot of bridges trying to literally build one over Harbor Boulevard. Disney took some lessons from that, and I think there was an enormous amount of outreach to not just the Planning Commission, but people in the community as well, trying to dot all of those I's, cross all of those T's, so that when they got to this point, a lot of the potential opposition that could have come about to this proposal was already addressed. And I think that's why you saw it eventually pass with that 5-1 vote.
Talking with Robert Niles, so Disney would put at least $1.9 billion into this development. What have we seen as far as projections about the economic impact that could have for Anaheim? I'm also wondering if we've seen any data on just, what Disney could get out of it. Obviously, it would add to the desire of people to want to come to their park. But what was the city supposed to get as a result of this?
Basically, this allows Disneyland to essentially build hotels and attractions on the site of its current surface parking lots. One element that's not part of this is that Disneyland does have approval to build a giant new parking structure east of Harbor next to I-5. And that'll handle all the parking capacity that would be lost when they start building things on Toy Story Lot and Downtown Disney parking lot. But there's potential for enormous economic benefit for the city of Anaheim. This will be something that can drive attendance to the Disneyland Resort, not just keeping it where it currently is, but driving new attendance, making it more attractive to people outside of the area. There'll be new hotels. That means new bed taxes coming into the city of Anaheim. And then there's the multiplier effect that when you start adding new construction jobs to this while it's being built, and then new operational jobs after it's constructed, that will benefit the city of Anaheim for decades to come.
As good as those things sound, obviously there were some residents of Anaheim who were concerned. Yusra touched on this earlier about Disney's plans to take on streets, including Magic Way. I think that there's some pushback on that they would maybe be essentially not giving access to some neighboring hotels, some neighboring motels, leaving the residents in the area to deal with more traffic on Ball Road and Catella. What have you heard about that?
Basically, Disney did do a traffic study that showed that I think something like 99% of the traffic on Magic Way were people coming to or from Disney properties. So that ultimately, Disney seems to believe that this is something that could potentially help with reducing traffic on Walnut, which would be a benefit to the immediate neighbors, but they would also preserve some pedestrian access so the people that live nearby would still be able to walk into the resort without having to walk all the way around the property itself. I think that if you are actually putting a lot of the traffic into this new parking structure that will have better access to I-5 on the east side, you're potentially reducing some of the traffic that's currently going to the surface lots via city surface streets right now at Toy Story Lot and the Downtown Disney Lot. But that's something that ultimately we're going to need to see in practice, because if attendance keeps going up, then yeah, traffic is going to continue to be an issue. And that's not just an issue for the city of Anaheim, but for all of Southern California.
You're listening to Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, in today for Larry Mantle. And we are talking about Disneyland and their plans to reimagine a space, their parking lot area. And it's just recently cleared Anaheim's Planning Commission. For folks who are listening in, who live in Anaheim, if you have thoughts about this proposal, it is going to go before the city council, I believe, next month. But if you have thoughts about this or maybe some concerns, 866-893-5722 is our number. Again, that's 866-893-5722. And I'm talking right now with Robert Niles, editor of the news site ThemeParkInsider.com. Robert, I think that Disney's kind of played it close to the vest as to what they would do with this space. Mm-hmm. But what are some theories right now about what this area, if it was allowed to be developed, could turn into?
Yeah, I think Disney very much wanted to keep this from becoming a referendum about specific plans that they might have for these parking lots in terms of what would be developed on them. They wanted to keep this kind of almost theoretical discussion about zoning. So they haven't announced anything, and they won't announce anything until after it gets approved from the city council. But they have dropped a lot of hints. Obviously, there's been some concept art that's been circulating in the community that Disney has released. And Disney Parks officials have talked about building Anaheim versions of single franchise lands that they've built in other parks around the world, such as World of Frozen that just debuted in Hong Kong, Zootopia that just debuted at Shanghai Disneyland. They've talked about doing a Black Panther-themed Wakanda land at one point. And Bob Iger just last week again said that they're planning on building a second Avatar-themed land somewhere at Disneyland. That's currently at Disney's Animal Kingdom at the Walt Disney World Resort in Florida.
So in some ways, it's almost like they haven't said much, and yet they've also kind of been like, hey, you know, giving people something to get excited about a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, they've talked about this potentially as being expansions of Disneyland and Disney California Adventure. However, they haven't ruled out the possibility that they could just do this as a third gate at the Anaheim Resort. So really, I mean, I don't think we'll get answers on this, like I said, until the city council approves it. And I would circle that big D23 convention that's coming to the Anaheim Convention Center in August. That's the venue where they typically announce big new projects. And if they have the Disneyland board approval, that's where I expect to see the future of the Disneyland Resort being detailed to the public for the first time.
Talking right now with Robert Niles, editor of the news site ThemeParkInsider.com. We also have Yusra Farzan on the line. Yusra has been covering this story for us at LAist. Yusra, I know that there was an environmental impact report done on the proposed construction. Obviously, nearby residents might be a little bit concerned about noise, traffic, things like that. Have you heard much about this?
Yes, Austin. So it did show that it was going to have significant effects, such as noise pollution, air quality, greenhouse gas emissions. And it was sort of brought up again in the Planning Commission meeting yesterday. But the staff recommended that the Planning Commissioners approve it because even though, you know, it had these negative impacts, they said that the benefits to the city were more in the fact that it was going to bring in jobs, and it would not affect transportation, or it would not affect the neighborhood aesthetics. So they did ask their Planning Commissioners to approve it yesterday.
Also worth mentioning that, when Disney World did some expansion in Florida, They funded some affordable housing projects near Disney World. And now it looks like Disneyland is also promising some money for affordable housing in Anaheim. What are we hearing about that?
Yeah, in their staff report yesterday that came out, you know, for the Planning Commission, I saw that, you know, they were promising at least $30 million from Disney for affordable housing. And this is within 5 years of the project's approval. And it's not just affordable housing. They're also promising money towards street and transportation improvements, as well as sewer improvements along Cotilla Avenue.
Robert Niles, editor of the news site Theme Park Insider. We have about a minute left, but I'll put it to you. This will go before the Anaheim City Council, likely in mid-April. You say nothing's a foregone conclusion. any predictions that you'd like to throw out, though?
Well, with the staff recommendation to move forward with this and with the Planning Commission voting 5-1, I would be very surprised to see the City Council reject this, particularly given the current makeup of the Anaheim City Council. So I would, if I were Disneyland, I'd probably be cautiously optimistic at this point in time. But again, there's plenty of opportunity for the public to have input on this to make sure that the Anaheim City Council is doing something that truly is in the best interest of the entire community, not just Disneyland, but everyone who lives in Anaheim.
So maybe putting the champagne on ice, but not opening it yet is what I'm hearing.
That's good.
Robert Niles, editor of news site themeparkinsider.com. Yusra Farzan was also with us, reporter for LAist. And this is Air Talk on a Tuesday. I'm Austin Cross in today for Larry Mantle. When we come back, a new report is outlining LAPD's use of less lethal launchers. They fire these 40-millimeter projectiles. So maybe think a small soda can, hardened foam at people. It's seen as, of course, less deadly than an actual bullet. But there's also a lot of concern right now about how much they are being used, how they are being used. We're going to talk about just what they are when we come back. We're going to get some information on it, look at how they're being used, and also hear what people are saying about it. We're back in 60 seconds on Air Talk.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross in today for Larry Mantle. A new report from the LAPD takes a look at the use of less lethal weapons. One in particular, it's called the 40-millimeter less lethal launcher. And it works by firing these hard foam pellets at more than 200 miles per hour. Now, according to the report last year, officers fired 133 rounds in 74 separate incidents. And they say about 37% of the time those discharges led to the desired result of the officers. Now, the LAPD is the largest agency in the country to use these launchers. And we want to talk about the numbers, about how and when officers decide to use them. And so let's start this conversation. There's going to be a few voices in it, but let's start it with Travis Norton. Travis is a retired police lieutenant who has conducted trainings in the use of non-lethal force. So, Travis, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Just to start us off, what do you make of the numbers from this report?
Well, one thing we need to keep in mind is that impact munitions are one of the most forceful, less lethal options that can be used for a lot of different applications. The premise of these systems is to deliver blunt force impact similar to a baton strike at a safe distance. And what it allows us to do is fill the gap between ordering someone to comply and then using lethal force. It's really hard to say by the numbers without digging deep and doing really good analysis of those things. And that's one of the issues with agencies. If we talk about the efficacy of these systems, is that we don't do a good job tracking their usage and the circumstances under which they were used. So it's really hard to say without some context of each one of those employments.
And I should mention that the LAPD Police Commission asked for this report after the deadly shooting of Jason McConney by police. His family says that he was having a bipolar episode. Officers fired this projectile, the 40-millimeter projectile, as well as two beanbag rounds at him while he walked toward them. It was later revealed that he wasn't holding a weapon. It was a plastic fork. But he was then fatally shot. So now his family is suing. Commission has asked for this report. You said that this is a pretty forceful way to work with people or to handle people. As you do training for this device, how does this training come through? Are you told where to shoot the weapon, situations when to use it? Can you kind of break down how, when this weapon is applied?
Sure. So the system itself is meant to inflict pain to cause a change in behavior. The issue, the challenge becomes pain is highly subjective. So what is painful to one person could be only mildly irritating to another. And we talk about effectiveness of the platform. A less lethal weapon primarily attempts to defeat a subject's ability to resist. A less lethal device attempts to defeat their ability to resist. Okay. So an adversary's ability to resist is measurable. A person's will, on the other hand, is intangible and cannot be measured. Now, if we talk about training, instructors, you know, you usually get an 8-hour training day. You requalify with that platform once a year. But the challenge becomes is instructors can teach where to target when employing impact munitions, but they can't predict the physical responses by the individuals. Humans are all different, and we have different responses that widely vary. Which is a real challenge for this system.
Talking right now with Travis Norton, a retired police lieutenant who's conducted trainings in the use of non-lethal force, and we are talking about these foam rounds, the 40-millimeter foam rounds, and how they are used. It seems there's a lot of question, Travis, about this term effective or even the term safe, because it doesn't really seem like they're clearly defined in this sort of situation, does it?
No, and you know, a bruised subject, suspect who survives an encounter that would otherwise have resulted in their death, someone armed with a knife, doesn't meet the standards of safe in a lot of circles. And it appears that where a person is hit has a greater influence on the degree of injury than the type of option that was used. And this is one topic that is ripe for further study. In the last 20 years, there's been virtually no breakthroughs and beyond prototypes and pilot projects, and improvements have been limited to essentially enhancing existing technologies. And what really needs to help remedy this situation is I would encourage politicians to help fund studies by the National Institute of Justice so we can get, you know, agencies good, solid data on their use.
Let's bring into the conversation Jim McDonald, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC. He's former sheriff of Los Angeles County, served 29 years with LAPD, including as first assistant chief, and was also chief of the Long Beach Police Department. Jim McDonald, thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Austin.
Let's start with your reaction to this report as well.
You know, I think Travis said it very well in answering the questions that you put forth. I think when you look at the big picture, what does a patrol officer or a deputy in the field have at their disposal when they roll up on a scene? And generally, it goes from verbalization and firm grip if the situation goes in that direction. You have the baton, you have OC spray and the taser, beanbag, as you mentioned, and then pepper ball in some cases, and then ultimately deadly force. The goal throughout the whole thing is not to use any force, is to de-escalate a volatile situation and be able to talk the person into a position where you can get them whatever help you can. The whole picture is guided by law, by policy, by training, supervision and management, a review process. You have a chain of command that reviews the uses of these tools. You have an inspector general who oversees that investigation, a chief of police who makes a almost final review, and then in the case of LAPD, the police commission makes the final adjudication on significant uses of force. And so when you look at what do we expect from officers in the field, I think we expect an awful lot. But when these things happen, they happen sometimes within a second or less. And you have very little time to be able to step back and make further assessments. You just have to respond based on your training and your assessment of danger to yourself or to others in that environment. And so in looking at where we are, this is a tool that I believe you will see patrol options across the country being issued more frequently because it does give you that standoff advantage with a suspect who may be armed with a knife or in some cases a sword, a machete, or other object like that, and be able to keep them in a position so that you can hopefully, through verbalization, de-escalate the situation and take them into custody.
Talking right now with former Los Angeles County Sheriff Jim McDonald, who is now director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC. I understand these devices were predominantly used by the SWAT team up until recently. And I know it's been some time since you were with the LAPD and the Sheriff's Department, but how were those devices deployed in your time with those agencies?
Yeah, no, it was considered a specialized tool, and they were deployed to specialized units. And what we've seen is over the years, we constantly are looking for new tools to be able to give those closest to the issue on the street, which are patrol officers, all the tools they need to be able to be as successful and protect the community as well as they possibly can. In this case, the 40-millimeter projectile, the LLL, as it's called, is a great tool to be able to provide that standoff in a situation where otherwise, deadly force may have been the only alternative. And it's cited there that it's only effective about a third of the time. And ideally, you'd love to see something much more effective. But I think when you put that in perspective, that's a third of the cases you deal with, it doesn't go to deadly force. And so it's a tool. And the other tools that I mentioned earlier, the baton, the OC spray, the taser, the beanbag, none of those tools are effective all the time either. And as Travis, I think, eloquently laid out, it's a situation you're in where every person you deal with is different. Their pain threshold is different. Their condition is different. So you have to be able to use whatever tool it makes the most sense for the circumstances. And in many cases, you have very little time to make those decisions.
We're talking about a new report that outlines the LAPD's use of less lethal launchers. A 40-millimeter launcher was used in the shooting of Jason McConney. That's what actually led the police commission to ask for this report. Jason McConney died after he was hit by a 40-millimeter projectile as well as two beanbag rounds. He was walking towards officers holding a plastic fork. Jim McDonald, I should probably raise what Police Commission President Errol Southers did say about this report, the department study. He says that he wished it had gone further to look into why departments in other cities such as New York and Chicago do not deploy these launchers in day-to-day operations. I believe it's us and it is Houston. And of course, our population is different from Houston. We certainly use it more than Houston. But is it worth considering why other large cities are not using it? Or do you think that there is something, and I know there's a lot of parts to this question, but or do you think there is something about the situations that officers are encountering here in this city that make it maybe a much more useful tool than in those places?
Yeah, I don't think it's so much what the LAPD officers face is different from other major cities across America. But I do think that, as we've seen throughout the last 50 years, that in many cases, LAPD has been on the forefront of testing and evaluation of new tools and tactics and kind of been a forerunner. And other departments have seen that. We meet together regularly with major city chiefs, major county sheriffs, and talk about best practices and share thoughts and ideas on how do we do the job better with an eye toward continuous improvement. And so when I look at other cities, I think there will be evaluations made and you will see adoption of this tool by more and more cities across America at the patrol officer level, because it's giving patrol officers who are dealing with the encounter, when it's fresh, not waiting for specialized units to respond, given them the tools they need to be as successful as they can be.
Talking right now with Jim McDonald, director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC. He's a former sheriff of Los Angeles County. He served 29 years with LAPD, and he was also chief of the Long Beach Police Department. Now, let us bring into this conversation Lauren Bonds, executive director of the National Police Accountability Project. Lauren, thank you so much for coming on today.
Good morning.
Tell me about some major concerns that people might have, including yourself, when it comes to the use of these less lethal launchers.
Yes. So our organization, the National Police Accountability Project, we're a group of civil rights attorneys, and I would say that we have dozens of cases where our clients were injured as a result of use of these weapons. We're talking about a situation in which someone was killed, but these are very harmful weapons that even when they aren't ultimately lethal in their consequences, we've had clients that have been permanently blinded. We've had clients that have gotten, TBIs, experienced other significant injuries that required surgery and rehabilitative therapy. And a lot of these have been the result of their indiscriminate and much further away use during protests. And so we have kind of definitely those concerns when they're used one-on-one with an individual at a close range.
I mean, as far as your concerns go, I know in the one-on-one sort of situations, officers likely aiming at one person trying to achieve an outcome, obviously subduing the person. When it comes to crowd dispersal and things like that, it could feel a lot more indiscriminate. What alternatives do you see in either of these situations? And I'd imagine, before I even finish this question, I'd imagine a lot of it comes down to whether even a force is necessary. But what do you see maybe being an alternative in these situations?
Yeah, and I think Travis raised a good point at the beginning that, there's a lot of different situations and everything is context specific. But, starting with the crowd dispersal protest context, a lot of times force isn't necessary to disperse a crowd. And I think that was a big upshot from the 2020 protest that happened over the summer of 2020 following George Floyd's murder is that, there were other ways to disperse a crowd, or if a crowd was out there and not dispersing, it wasn't a situation that required the level of force that was used. So I think it really does go back to that question. And to Travis's point, there needs to be, kind of individualized assessment. Everyone's going to react differently. So if you are shooting, projectiles that are, whether they're tear gas or whether they're these, sponge rounds that can be very painful and forceful, you don't know if it's going to be you're hitting somebody who could die as a result of it due to some medical vulnerability or somebody who it's barely going to impact. And so I think really going back to kind of the question of is force necessary is the important inquiry there. Similarly, I would say with one-on-one individualized kind of contacts between a police officer and a civilian, the situation we're discussing is one in which somebody, was in a mental health crisis. And, it was raised that this is a situation where, verbal commands aren't de-escalating the situation. I think that raises the question about whether a police officer is the best person trained to interact with a person when they are in a mental health crisis, particularly in a situation like this where they weren't actually armed with a deadly weapon or a weapon, really a weapon of any kind. So I think ultimately, that's where we land often is just going back to the purpose of the interaction. Was force necessary? There may be certain situations where force is necessary, but being able to find something that's a bit more modulated than, these very forceful, harmful weapons.
Talking right now with Lauren Bonds, Executive Director of the National Police Accountability Project. I guess my final question to you, Lauren, this LAPD report, which I should say again, was asked for by the police commission after that deadly shooting of Jason McConney. It did not take into account, I believe, situations where crowd control was the purpose. as we go forward, is there more information that you would like to see from departments, or maybe even a new level of dialogue that you would like to see the departments having with their communities when it comes to the use of both police presence, but also weapons, non-lethal rounds, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, I think in the conversation between the police department, their communities, and elected officials representing communities is important. But I do think that there's a lot of evidence and information that's out there that I think might be a helpful pre-step for police departments to consider. The Physicians for Human Rights, issued a report just last year on the use of less than lethal weapons at protests that really documented how harmful and injurious, for lack of a better word, these particular weapons are. And we've also, seen other states. Colorado, it really limited the use of less lethal projectiles, saying that they shouldn't be aimed at someone's head or used indiscriminately fired into the crowd. So we have, kind of beta tested restrictions on less lethal projectiles that I think could be considered and should be reviewed by any police department that's still using them.
Lauren Bonds is Executive Director of the National Police Accountability Project. We also heard from Jim McDonald, Director of the Safe Communities Institute at USC, also former Sheriff of Los Angeles County. And we also heard from Travis Norton, who is a retired police lieutenant who has conducted trainings in the use of non-lethal force. My thanks to all of our guests for joining us today. When we come back, much has been said that you've probably heard about the supposed health benefits of red wine. And it turns out that it might not necessarily be so. We're going to talk about that when we come back on Air Talk. Stick around.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk here on LAS 89.3. Austin Cross with you in for Larry Mantle today. Red wine might not be our friend like we thought it was. For years, it's been associated with good heart health. According to a recent piece in the New York Times, though, this belief that most of us have had, I grew up with, can be traced back to a 60 Minutes segment from 1991. And it featured a French researcher who said the drink could potentially reduce blockages and heart attacks. Now, experts say the studies at the time supported the theory, but reanalysis has been a lot less fun. They've poked a lot of holes in it. Let's get into this with Dr. Gregory Marcus, cardiologist and professor of medicine at UC San Francisco. Dr. Marcus, thank you for coming on Air Talk today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you speak at all, Dr. Marcus, to just what we saw after that 60-minute segment? I think I saw that the next year red wine sales rose, say, 40%. Have you encountered a lot of people who had this belief that red wine had some major health benefits?
Definitely. This is a very common question that my patients will ask. Should I drink a glass of red wine or not? In fact, when I was in the coronary care unit as a resident at Stanford, one of our attendings, one of the faculty, used to make sure that those patients were receiving red wine with their dinner.
Oh, my. Well, obviously, new research is out now that doesn't really support this. Can you tell us about what research has said since the 60 Minutes special brought to light the French researchers' findings?
Yeah, so it is complicated and multifactorial and important to make some distinctions. So First, what has become really crystal clear is that excessive drinking, which I would describe, and this is not just my opinion, this is based on the evidence, meaning more than two drinks, and this really applies to any alcohol, but includes red wine, probably more than one drink, is overall harmful to health. The issue with the past studies is that they're all what we call observational, as opposed to experimental or randomized. And whenever there's an observational study, there's always a concern that there could be confounding, meaning there's some other causal factor that actually is important that just travels with whatever our predictor is, in this case, red wine. Also in the interim, there have been very rigorous studies, including randomized trials, which is new to our field, mainly in my specific field of arrhythmias, examining the relationship among people who are randomly assigned to, for example, continue to drink versus avoid to drink. We did a randomized study where we actually infused intravenous alcohol versus a placebo. And the evidence is that there really does seem to be a causal relationship between alcohol consumption and this very common abnormal heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation. Now, very importantly, and I actually fear that the pendulum has swung a little too far back, as I think is exemplified by the article you referenced in the New York Times, there's a really important unknown that we think is deserving of a randomized trial. And that is, what about if you really do limit your alcohol consumption to, for example, one glass of red wine with dinner, which incidentally is consistent with the Mediterranean diet, which is one of the few diets that has been shown in randomized trials to be beneficial to overall health and heart health. And part of that diet is an option. It's not required, but it's an option that essentially saying it's okay to have what we would call a high polyphenol, low alcohol drink, such as red wine being the exemplar of that, with dinner, no more than one, on 5 to 7 days a week. We still don't know really whether the overall health benefits, and especially the heart benefits or harms, favor that versus complete abstinence. So I think, you know, it's really important. And as someone that does a lot of research in this field, I worry that things have gotten a little political, not in terms of Democrat versus Republican, but there's almost a fashion here that right now, again, as demonstrated by that that article, that even one glass of red wine may be considered harmful, whereas I don't think the evidence favors that. But very importantly, more is definitely not better. So more than that, excessive alcohol, more than one drink a day, pretty much no question that it's harmful. And for individuals who have this arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, or who want to do everything they can to avoid it, who have first-degree family members, parents, brothers, sisters with atrial fibrillation, probably the best thing really is to avoid alcohol.
Talking right now with Gregory Marcus, Dr. Gregory Marcus, cardiologist and professor of medicine at UCSF. We do have to break in just a second, but I want to bring Jennifer Hay into this conversation. Jennifer is a behavioral scientist, cancer psychologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Jennifer, thank you to you for coming on.
Absolutely. Very, very happy to be here.
I kind of want to touch on this. It almost becomes a style, as Dr. Marcus touched on, especially after the 60-minute segment, where I think that maybe people's relationship with alcohol became much less scientific, I would say, but it just kind of almost became anecdotal. For the people who didn't catch the 60-minute segment, they'd say, oh, well, I heard, or they say that, you know, the royal they. You know, they say that this is good for us. Can you maybe talk to me about the role that media actually plays in creating people's views on what might be considered good for them versus not, and maybe how unscientific a lot of times that can be.
Yeah, well, I can, and you know, my perspective is very much from the cancer world, you know, as an attending at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and that's my patient population and focus, is that I think one of the media harms from the 60 Minute piece is that the idea that red wine, it was healthy, sort of extrapolated to cancer. And so at this point, many people are quite unaware that all forms of alcohol, including wine, increase cancer risk. You know, when I talk to my patients about this, and, you know, certainly in my research program, it really comes as a surprise that the cancer risks might be actually separate and a really distinct issue from the heart disease risks, as Dr. Marcus has talked about so well. You know, so I think that one of the things that we really need to think about is, you know, the cancer risk, even, you know, common cancers like breast cancer and colorectal cancer are increased, you know, based on more and more alcohol consumption. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I think the media has had a huge element here. And, you know, it's almost like red wine has come to represent the good life, or, you know, having a healthy diet, or, you know, relaxing, enjoying one's life. So all of these positive connotations have been promulgated in the media and really kind of come full circle when we start to talk about different illnesses such as cancer.
Talking right now with Jennifer Hay, a behavioral scientist and cancer psychologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. We're talking about red wine, specifically a glass of red wine a day might not keep the doctor away after all. Some new research that's come out since it kind of became public common knowledge that red wine was supposedly good for you. Now there's research that says might not be the case. We're going to continue our conversation when we come back on Air Talk. Stick around. It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross, in today for Larry Mantle, and we're talking about red wine. Specifically, back in 1991, you might have seen or you might have heard about a report from a French researcher who said that a glass of red wine a day could actually be good for you. But there's also new research that says that might not really be the case. And in fact, alcohol consumption can have some very negative effects on your health. Let me bring Dr. Gregory Marcus back into the conversation. He's a cardiologist and professor of medicine at UCSF. As you were talking before the break, Doctor, it stood out to me, it almost felt like how epidemiologists, public health experts were navigating the pandemic, where they realized that they had to come up with policies that were realistic for people's lives, even if it wasn't exactly what the ideal situation would be, but you had to take into account people's behaviors and how they acted. And I kind of wonder if this is a similar case now where, you know, you've said, you know, there could be, but there's also a lot of, you know, reasons why alcohol is not good for you. That glass of red wine is not good for you. But it almost sounds like you're trying to talk to somebody who's saying, I want to drink red wine. Why can't I drink red wine? Can I have it in this case? Can I have it in that case? Like, you're talking to somebody who's determined to have it is what it feels like. But I want to ask, there's probably better, healthier options out there to go with meals, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that one of the things that makes this topic tricky is that generally there's this sense that simple is true. There's a messaging issue, and some would argue that, well, if you're trying to communicate this fairly nuanced, complex message that there's a certain amount of low levels of alcohol that might be okay, that that could lead to harm, because it's just the human, it's just human nature to extrapolate and say, oh, well, the doctor said it was okay.
Right.
So those, you know, prone to drinking more are gonna do that. And, you know, one of the really important limitations of previous studies is that, not surprisingly, they relied on self-report of alcohol consumption. So how do we know who's drinking more or less? It's the way they filled out that survey. Mm. So this is part of, this has been a focus of my group's research, is to try to circumvent that, which we've done, for example, with sensors that continuously record alcohol while people are wearing continuously recording EKGs. And we did find in these patients with this arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, that even one drink really did predict a heightened risk of a discrete arrhythmia episode within just a few hours. We've also looked at healthcare coding, for example, for alcohol use disorders or alcohol abuse. So again, not relying on individuals telling us how much they drink. We looked at essentially everyone coming to the hospital in California or any ER visit, so millions and millions of patients, and more alcohol consumption was associated with not just this arrhythmia, but a higher risk of heart attack or myocardial infarction. So again, emphasizing this, you know, more is not better. But you're absolutely right. It's tricky from a public health standpoint to determine precisely how to message this. It's not unreasonable to say, well, isn't it just easier to just recommend someone consume something else? Of course, we don't want people to substitute their glass of red wine for a sugary beverage. Mm. There's more recent evidence that even the diet sodas may be harmful. You know, we often will say water is the best thing for you. But again, I do think there's a role for more research here to enable us to provide more very specific prescriptions for the public and for our patients.
Jennifer Hay, behavioral scientist, I got about 20 seconds left, but any observations, thoughts, last thoughts that you'd have in this conversation?
You know, I think it's a message that we've been putting out is less is best from a cancer's perspective. Less is best. And that there are certain subpopulations that are going to be very interested in this. Cancer survivors, those are who are at higher risk for developing cancer. But that really for the overall population, we just want everyone to be informed, because it really is a personal decision to drink and how much to drink. And we really believe that everybody deserves that information in order to make the best decisions for themselves.
Jennifer Hay, behavioral scientist, cancer psychologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. We also heard from Dr. Gregory Marcus, cardiologist and professor of medicine at UCSF. My thanks to both of our guests today. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle, back with more Air Talk after this.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle today. So nice to have you with us. Coming up a little bit later, we're going to talk about jewelry. Now, young folks just aren't buying it quite the same way as older generations. We're going to look at the trends in that industry, but I also will want to hear from you about maybe some piece of jewelry that you have inherited that means a lot to you. Why it means a lot to you. We're going to talk about that later in the show. Well, it is Civic Learning Week for folks at the nonprofit iCivics. It's a time when they bring together schools, policymakers, and educators to examine the state of civic education in America. And they're bringing in some heavy hitters today. A national forum is happening in D.C. It is featuring two Supreme Court justices. There will also be panels focused on disinformation, how that affects civic learning, and maybe how civics education can help us overcome political division. Joining me to talk about this, two people involved with these panels who also have ties to SoCal here. Joseph Kahn is professor for education policy and politics at UC Riverside, where he is also co-director of the Civic Engagement Research Group. Professor Kahn, welcome to you.
Hey, welcome.
Also on the line with us, Vivian Elisa Shepherd-Mahon, Civic Leaders Fellow at the Ronald Reagan Institute and a second-year undergrad student at Stanford University. Vivian, welcome to you as well.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Well, just to start us off, Joseph Kahn, can you just tell us a little bit about what the Civic Engagement Research Group at UC Riverside does?
Sure, thanks. We sort of like our title, we look for ways to support the design and implementation of civic learning opportunities for young people in schools and in youth organizations and elsewhere. And we also study those efforts to try to figure out how to make them more effective.
Well, so talk to me in your view about the state of civics education in America today. Maybe what's working and where that education might be falling short in today's political atmosphere.
Yeah, so I think a couple of things you were just hinting at in your question. So first, there is quite a bit of civic education that goes on. As many of your listeners know, there's a required government course in California that students take in high school. And there are many other opportunities throughout the curriculum, as well as things like service learning opportunities where students can get involved. And many of those experiences can be quite impactful. There's also an increased focus now on media literacy and helping folks not only learn how to judge the credibility of information, but also how to produce and share their own information and do that in, you know, impactful and thoughtful ways.
So I just want to point out, so very different from my civic education, there's now a component where you can tell young people how they can get their voice out there and get the right information out there.
I think that's really important, yeah. I think that we don't want to just focus on young people or anybody just as a consumer of information. We want to also recognize that they can share their own thoughts and they can circulate the thoughts of others, and that it's key to do that, you know, thoughtfully and responsibly about what it is that you are sharing.
No, I believe I cut you off, so I want to let you finish and continue your point.
Well, you were just asking, you know, what's the state of it? So there is some stuff that's very good, but I would say many young people aren't getting really what we might think of as enough opportunities or the best opportunities to really have their voice, to exercise their voice and think about what they might believe or know or learn about issues that they care about. And due to the political context, which you hinted at in your question, a lot of teachers are feeling very hesitant often to talk about controversial issues in the classroom because it can be so contentious and difficult both among students in the class, but also sometimes with parents and community members jumping in, not always in fair ways, and critiquing the teachers for doing that work.
I mean, because of this, because of what we've seen happening across the country with school boards, in classrooms, with book bans even, has this had a chilling effect on teachers' abilities to fully have the conversations necessary to equip a young person who is entering into a very political world post, you know, schooling?
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's been a chilling effect, and we're seeing that both in our own data and in other people's studies. So I just completed a study with John Rogers at UCLA where we surveyed principals around the country, but especially in California. And what we found was that the amount of professional development and support for doing some of these kinds of best practices in civics, like having controversial issue discussions, is down significantly. And it's especially down, this may not be surprising, in sort of purple communities, which are places where there has been the most contention.
Talking right now with Joseph Kahn, professor for education policy and politics at UC Riverside, where he is also director of the Civic Engagement Research Group. And we're talking about Civic Learning Week for the folks at the nonprofit iCivics. They're holding a number of panels today, a forum in D.C. featuring two Supreme Court justices. Let's bring into the conversation Vivian Elisa Shepherd-Mahan, who is a Civic Leaders Fellow at the Ronald Reagan Institute and a second-year undergrad student at Stanford University. Vivian, can you talk to me a little bit about what sparked your interest in civic engagement at such a young age?
Yeah, I would love to. I think I grew up in a community of immigrants in Southern California, and transitioning from a community that maybe didn't have access to voting, or it wasn't something that was part of the culture or something that was encouraged by teachers, by community members, and just overall, our civic education was not very strong. And then transitioning to a place like Stanford, where Democracy Day exists and our voting is like very much talked about and a part of our lives as students and a part of our lives as just people after we graduate. It was really interesting to me to see about like what made me feel more connected to my role as a citizen in this country, and like how can we recreate that connection for other people in disadvantaged communities. I think as was previously mentioned, like even though there is requirements for government classes, like the quality of those classes does have impact on their overall effectiveness. And so if students in underserved communities that already feel underrepresented are also not given quality access to education around civics, that will lead to further disengagement and not wanting to continue to engage as they grow older.
Now, Vivian, the panel that you were a part of earlier today looked at how mis and disinformation affects civic learning. I'm curious what you and your fellow panelists discussed, but also just among your peer group, how often mis or disinformation comes up as a topic of either concern, or you hear somebody spouting off something that they heard online that's just not really verified. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think today we talked a lot about like the role that social media has in that, and both the benefits and disadvantages of how misinformation and disinformation can be spread. We also talked about how like different voices are allowed to be given platform on these social media, websites like TikTok and Instagram, people who normally wouldn't be given mainstream access to like a news cable channel or even like a radio show are able to show like first eyewitness into what they're going through, but that also leads to like a lack of verification, which is I think what most young people focus on and what I talk about amongst my peers. It's very interesting and intimate to see people go through things like wars and other social issues. As they're protesting and stuff, they're able to give us the personal perspective that they have, but also how do we contrast that to like 100 other perspectives that are also being shown online? And I think we're still learning how to navigate what is factual. But in some regards, I think that because we grew up with the internet, we do have a lot of tools to see what maybe is unrealistic and what could be a little bit too extreme one direction or the other. Whereas you see a lot of people in older generations kind of believing things on like Facebook, for example, and we get sent them by our family, and then we're discussing like, oh, can you believe that so-and-so thought this was real? And, right. You know, just those conversations, they go back and forth amongst generations, I think.
So talk to me about some of the tools that you and people in your age group use to verify information today.
Yeah, I think they're not necessarily like one specific tool, which is I think where maybe that's where it's ineffective. It's kind of us looking it up and seeing if different sources are saying the same thing, or if the person who is speaking has like a vetted interest in saying that. So a lot of times when you see research, it's funded by a group who would benefit from a certain outcome. And I think that's where most of the tool comes from, is our ability to really look into and have open access into the people who are saying the things that they're saying. And we're able to hold them accountable in a way that maybe isn't possible before.
Talking right now with Vivian Elisa Shepherd-Mahan, who is a civics leader fellow at the Ronald Reagan Institute and a second-year undergrad student at Stanford University. We're talking about Civics Week. And Joseph Kahn, professor for education policy and politics at UC Riverside, as we look to the future of educating young people about civics, about politics, teaching them to raise their voice, whose job is it to make the next move, and to where do we turn for that? Because I'd imagine for people listening in, they'd say, well, this is well and good that we want to improve the civics education, really cool that young people are being taught to raise their voices on the same social media platforms. But where does it go from here? And is it a question of funding? Is it a question of policy? I want to put that question to you.
You know, so I think it's yes to a bunch of the things you were saying. So first, while it's true that the federal government spends about $50 per student on STEM education, it spends about 5 cents per student on civics education. So part of the answer is there's a need for resources which would allow for more innovation and support and making this a priority. But that you're only going to get that if the public asks for it, if educators ask for it, if students are given opportunities to push for it. And so that's a piece of it. Another big piece of, I think, what we need is we need to create the supports for educators and students to pursue these goals. So professional development opportunities, the creation of new programs is all vitally important because, honestly, in today's climate, it's not easy always for a teacher, for example, to have a conversation. You know, we're moving into election season. That's going to be intimidating for a lot of teachers for very understandable reasons. And they're going to be wondering, how can I manage this election? I want students to both be informed about it and I want them to be engaged with one another on it. And at the same time, I don't want to create a huge controversy that, you know, gets in the way of everything else I'm trying to do. And so they'll need support both from their leadership, from parents in the community, and in terms of professional development.
It is Civic Learning Week for the folks at the nonprofit iCivics. They bring together schools, policymakers, educators to look at civic education, the state of it in the U.S. Of course, there's a number of panels happening. Of course, and today in D.C., they're having a national forum featuring two Supreme Court justices. I want to thank our guests, Joseph Kahn, professor for education policy and politics at UC Riverside, where he's also director of the Civic Engagement Research Group. We also heard from Vivian Elisa Shepherd-Mayan, Civic Leaders Fellow at the Ronald Reagan Institute and a second-year undergrad student at Stanford University. My big thanks to our guests for joining us today. I'm Austin Cross, in today for Larry Mantle here on Air Talk. And coming up, what if AI, artificial intelligence, could allow us to have a conversation with sperm whales? Maybe other animals, maybe birds. What should we say? Should we say anything at all? Is it recommended that we say anything? Are we even interesting to them? We're going to talk about that when we come back in 60 seconds. Stick around.
The journalists in the LAist newsroom work for you.
I'm LAist higher education correspondent Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
What the students are speaking about, it is extremely valid.
My reporting is about how students use higher education toward a better life.
For the first time since being in this campus, it made me feel unsafe.
Struggling through challenges like ethnicity, class, poverty, and family pressures.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
I could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee. Imagine talking to a tiger, chatting with a cheetah. What a neat achievement it would be.
It's Air Talk.
If we could talk to the animals, learn all their languages, maybe take an animal degree.
Here on LA.
I'd study elephant and eagle, buffalo and beagle, alligator, guinea pig, and flea.
I'm Austin Cross. Thanks so much for hanging out with us on this Tuesday. I'm in for Larry Mantle today. Bobby Darin. Yeah, just the range that this guy had in his music. That's Talk with the Animals, which was made famous from the 1967 film Dr. Doolittle, which is also a wonderful classic. But it raises an important question. Who wouldn't want to share a few words with the animals? I mean, what if your cat or dog could snitch on you? Ooh, what would they say? But look, there's no serious research being done on, say, like man's best friend, your dog, your cat. Not quite yet. But some AI researchers think that communicating with intelligent creatures like sperm whales or crows may soon be a reality. But I mean, again, we come back to this question. What do we say to each other? Hey, sorry for the noise, the pollution, so the water may be a little too warm. But maybe we'd also be more inclined to listen to their desires, their needs, what's going wrong. So it feels like it's far in the future, but could be made possible by AI. Here to talk about AI research and if humans will ever be able to talk to their distant cousins, Lois Parshley, senior reporter at The Lever. Her article for the Scientific American is titled "Artificial Intelligence Could Finally Let Us Talk with the Animals." Lois, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to us about, because I'm sure this is the first a lot of folks are hearing about this, talk to us about the technology that could make this possible. How does it work?
Yeah, you've probably all heard about AI in the last year or so. Chatbots have seen a huge surge in popularity, and that technology is now poised to provide new insights into animal communication too. Beyond creating chatbots and producing art, machine learning may soon make it possible to help decipher animal vocalizations.
So let me also bring into the conversation right now Grant Van Horn, who is an assistant professor of computer science at the University of Massachusetts. Welcome to you.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I know that this is an area that you have worked in. Can you talk to us about that technology and how it operates, maybe on a step-by-step level?
Sure. So this is a space that I've been studying and trying to develop technology in for a while. There's a few popular identification systems out there for images, right? If you just take it with your camera, you can go outside, take a picture of a flower, a mammal or an insect and have your phone often give you a suggestion for the species. Mm. The audio stuff is actually quite similar. So we record on the microphone and we convert your audio actually into an image representation. And we run very similar machine learning algorithms on that visual representation of sound in order to figure out what is currently vocalizing or making some type of noise. So that's at a high level.
Is it like a waveform? Because I mean, here in the audio industry, of course, we're looking at waveforms. As a longtime producer, I could look at a waveform and say, "Oh, that's an that is a cough." Like, and you know how to cut it because you know what it looks like. Is it anything like that?
It's very similar. Yeah. So we take those waveforms, which are often they are just one dimensional signals, and we transform them into two dimensions. So we have frequency over time, and you can identify sort of visual patterns in that two dimensional signal where human speech often occupies a particular area of the image. Bird vocalizations are often higher pitched, higher frequency, and so they're at another area of the image. And similarly with bats and whales and various other animal species, often operating at different frequencies, and so you can kind of pick out these various often quite pretty patterns to distinguish when things are making a noise.
I mean, have you learned much about how they use language? I'm thinking, is it words that they're transmitting exactly, or is it feelings? Is it situations? Because I'm thinking about when you go out into a forest and you hear all the birds chattering up in the canopy. And I always wonder if they're saying, "Hey, there's somebody down there. Hey, everybody look out. There's a guy down there. He's looking at us." How do they use language essentially? Do we know yet?
Yeah. I mean, Lois, I don't mean to, sort of dominate this. If you'd like to answer this one, I'm happy to as well.
Lois, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear your perspective as well. I spoke to a number of researchers who were looking at different wildlife species, as well as one researcher who was working with domesticated pets, specifically dogs. And of course, we have to be careful when we use words like feelings around animals. But one of the people I spoke to was studying pigs and had created an algorithm trained on a large database that was learning to predict whether the pig was experiencing a positive or a negative emotion. And her hope was to provide better animal welfare, that this program could help farmers better understand if their animals were experiencing negative emotions.
Interesting. Grant, what do you think?
Yeah, so, my introduction to this whole space has really been around the species identification aspect of sounds, right? So, you know, whether it's mechanical or vocal production of sound, you know, we want to know which species produce that that noise. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's well documented that animals are using different vocalizations at different times to signify different events, whether it's a predator is nearby or that they're particularly fit for reproductive purposes, you know, or many other things. Yeah, sound and the production of sound has been a really useful mechanism for communicating.
That's so fascinating. Talking right now with Grant Van Horn, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Massachusetts. Lois, partially, you've written about how intelligent animals like sperm whales and their language could be pretty prime for this type of AI analysis. Why is that the case?
Whales are of particular interest to some researchers because they're very social, and so the sperm whales that Project SETI, for example, are studying have very sophisticated social interactions, which makes this a logical place to start applying some of this technology. The Earth Species Project, which is another group who is working on developing AI models along these lines, are already moving toward playback experiments, where researchers will use these models to essentially create an artificially generated call and play it back to a whale or in some cases zebra finches in a lab setting, and then see how the animal responds. You know, the plot twist is that we might be able to communicate with them before we understand what we're saying.
Well, so we might end up, you know, say, run, you know, like predator. And they're hearing that, and they're like, well, somebody around us says that there's a predator, so we got to hightail it out of here. This kind of puts me in one of those situations, though, where I'm thinking, well, we could maybe do that one day. Should we do that one day? What could possibly go wrong? What have you found, Lois?
Yeah, obviously, this research does raise some ethical questions. Certainly there's a question of unintended consequences. So one example of that could be if you can use AI to listen to an endangered animal, that could be really great for conservation work, but poachers could also deploy similar techniques to locate those animals or to impersonate their calls to lure them closer. So there are a lot of questions around how this technology might be applied, you know, in a similar way that people have questions about AI in other areas.
Grant Van Horn, Assistant Professor of Computer Science at the University of Massachusetts, in your work, has this question of should we even do this come up?
Yeah. Yeah, often in a slightly different context. So, you know, we are working hard to make engaging, you know, sort of public engagement applications, right? So Merlin Sound ID, the iNaturalist, and Seek applications. And so these
might need
these
to
are
explain
really
those
geared
to us a little bit.
Yeah. So Merlin Sound ID is a project from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And the goal there is to allow anyone with a smartphone to turn on their microphone. And if there are birds vocalizing nearby, you know, the app will tell you what is singing or calling. And similarly with iNaturalist and Seek, you know, those are more, those are on the image side. So take a picture of a flower or an insect and we'll try and tell you what it is. Our ambitions here are to kind of lower the bar to learning more about that wildlife in your backyard, right? Make it accessible and easy for you to identify you know, who's using your backyard, who are your neighbors, that have feathers, and how can you learn more about them, and we use these to start that process towards education and possibly making conservation type decisions in a more informed manner, right? Because you know what's there, or you know what should be there, and maybe it's declining for various reasons, and you care about it. So anyway, a lot of our research right now is just trying to get at a more basic level, just what is present at a given spot, whether it's vocalizing or just visible, as opposed to kind of going deeper into the language understanding. But those, the fascinating questions about language are, certainly on the research agenda, and we're, just kind of slowly chipping our way to getting to that point.
I'm curious, and this might not be an answerable question, but it just occurred to me to ask, but with so many different types of bird that one might have in their backyard, and you might be hearing several at once, do you get the sense at all, based off of your research, that one bird has any understanding of what another species of bird might be trying to communicate, like almost as if there is a similarity between German and Dutch German, so it's like close enough that you could kind of tell? Or does it seem right now like they're all kind of speaking different languages?
I think that a lot of these questions are kind of outstanding, right? It remains to be seen, and the data, I think we're just kind of getting to this exciting point where we have the data to start digging into those exact questions, right? If one bird vocalizes, what is the probability that, another species vocalizes within the next second, right? Is that a very high probability, or is it low? Is it random chance? What are the signals there? And it's one thing to do this in a lab setting, but it's a different thing to do this kind of out in the wild, where these animals are behaving more natural. And in those cases, you have a lot of complexities. You got other environmental noises, whether it's human noises or mammal or other avian species. And so there's a lot to compete with. And so that's what I was trying to refer to as, like, we're slowly chipping away at this problem of really trying to take a soundscape and break it down into these pieces that can then be further studied by, biologists and ecologists and other scientists.
Given the speed, sorry to interrupt you, but given the speed at which you're working on this, is there any estimate on your part when we might see major advancements where we could actually see this tried out either in a lab or in a nature setting?
I think these things are so hard to predict. It's machine learning right now is such an exciting field because we're finding similar techniques are kind of working, in many different problem domains. And it just allows us to make rapid advancements, right? So we can look at what the natural language processing researchers are doing with chatbots and take those ideas and apply them to acoustics or to images, and then vice versa. But it's hard to predict, but it's just a matter of time, it seems like, before we can start digging into these complex questions.
Lois Parshley, senior reporter at The Lever, in your reporting, what's been the most impressive use of AI when it comes to mapping animal communication that you've seen?
Honestly, and I can say this with fifth grade, I am obsessed with Merlin Sound ID. I use it almost every day now. Mm. It is so fun to know what birds are calling in my backyard, and it's made me think about the sounds I'm hearing in the world really differently. It is a super cool tool that's a free app that anyone can use. And I was drawn to this topic to begin with because I had a pair of sandhill cranes in my backyard who were, I believe, raising a nest. It seemed like they had a certain pattern and a courtship progressed. And then one morning I heard them making really loud, strange calls for a long period of time. And they flew off that day and never came back. So I was wondering if they had lost their nest to a predator. And I think that underlying curiosity about the animals that we share our world with is one of the things that this technology is both driven by and can help us better understand the world around us.
So fascinating. There's just a whole other reality playing out in the background of our reality. I find that so fascinating. Lois Parshley is senior reporter at The Lever. Her piece for Scientific American is titled "Artificial Intelligence Could Finally Let Us Talk to Animals." Lois, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We also heard from Grant Van Horn, assistant professor of computer science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's worked on popular wildlife ID applications such as iNaturalist, Seek, and Merlin Bird ID, which I'm totally going to check out after this. Grant, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
It just sounds so cool. As I was hearing it, I was thinking, this is something me and my wife would totally get into in our backyard, just sitting there and looking at what we hear. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle today. Thanks so much for hanging out with us this morning. When we come back, I'll actually want to hear from you. We're going to talk about jewelry, what has changed in the jewelry industry. Young people certainly have very different buying habits than, say, the baby boomer generation. We're going to look at that. But the question that I want to hear from you is this. Is there a piece of jewelry that you have inherited that's been handed down to you, either maybe by a friend, but also from family members, that just means a lot to you? You maybe wear it, or maybe you don't wear it because you're afraid that something could happen to it. But what is that piece of jewelry, and why is it special to you? I am so curious. Our phone number is 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. There's also atcomments@las.com. We are back in 90 seconds. It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. I'm Austin Cross in today for Larry Mantle. Thanks so much for cruising along with me. You know, I'm sure a lot of us have a memory of peering into our parents', maybe grandparents', jewelry boxes while they explain the origins of various rings, watches, maybe crosses, and maybe even making promises about the treasure that we will one day inherit. You know, sometimes I wonder what the children of millennials and Gen Zers are going to inherit, considering that young people don't really buy jewelry like previous generations anymore, right? Like, we're fine with a high-quality knockoff. And there's been a lot of changes in the jewelry industry, so we're going to talk about what those changes are. But the question that I mentioned before the break that I would love to hear from you on is this. Is there a piece of jewelry that you have inherited from your family, maybe from a friendship, maybe from a relationship that you hold on to that has a lot of sentimental value for you? What is it? Do you wear it often? Do you maybe not wear it because you're afraid that something might happen to it? I want to hear from you about that. Our number is 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. There's also atcomments@laist.com. There's also laist.com/airtalk. You can leave your thoughts there. But hey, we have a line open for you, so why not use it? 866-893-5722. With us to talk about this is Tara Gannon, LA-based jewelry designer and an expert on trends in the industry. Tara, thanks so much for being on with us today.
Hey, Austin. Thanks for having me.
Well, what have you noticed when it comes to trends in the jewelry industry today compared to, I don't know, 30 years in the past when it was a different generation that was doing the buying?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say to 30 years ago, if we're looking at, you know, that kind of time frame.
Or before even.
Well, you know, we have access to so much jewelry now through the internet, and we're able to, you know, watch TikTok and YouTube and really be able to, you know, understand like how we want to have our self-expression through jewelry. Whereas, you know, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, it was more, you know, it was really being passed down usually generationally, you know, from your parents. And it was more of these heirloom pieces, which we still, of course, have. But, you know, it was also back then you were going to your local jeweler who was probably, you know, in the center of your town. Mm-hmm. And it was a family jeweler. And now, yeah, we have access to just a lot more places that we can, you know, express ourselves and purchase jewelry. So I think that's the biggest shift that we've seen.
And as far as maybe tastes, what people are buying, the size, the kinds of stones or metals, I just feel like 20 years ago, I don't know, during the Pimp My Ride days, we were going through a real platinum phase. Like everybody was getting platinum everything, platinum grills, platinum, you know, chains. What are the trends looking like now in terms of, you know, materials, stones, et cetera, settings even?
Yeah, well, if we're looking at, you know, more of fine jewelry, again, it's a lot more gold at the moment. You know, it's, we still have that like bling moment where everyone really, you know, wants to be sparkly and shiny. But I think that moment of really decking yourself out in diamonds in like the 2010s has kind of passed. And it's a little bit more refined. I think similar to how we've had a movement in, you know, athleisure and activewear, we kind of have this now idea in our head that we want to go, you know, to a cafe, to the office, to work out, and then maybe a party in the evening. But we want jewelry that can kind of be functional for that whole day through and not have to change it. So I'd say that's something, you know, that we've seen a shift. And then we've also seen a shift, you know, with biometric technology. So whether that's the Oura ring or something that's kind of being able to multifunctional. So it could be tracking your sleep or, you know, just your overall health. And I think that's been, you know, something that's really new and I think going to expand even more in the future.
I'm wondering if attitudes toward wealth has maybe driven that kind of silent wealth movement that we've seen over the years. Of course, we've also seen instances where maybe a person bragged about their wealth and then their house was broken into or something like that. But I do wonder if there is, it happened famously to rapper Pop Smoke, if anybody keeps track of the hip hop community, it's a very big thing. He's showing it on social media. The next thing you know, somebody was breaking into his place to try to get what they were seeing. Do you think that, you know, social attitudes have kind of driven this change from, you know, being completely iced out to maybe, you know, a nice wearable, nice Apple Watch, maybe a nice One Ring or something like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think that even happened to Kim Kardashian, too. She had an incident where, you know, she posted stuff and then someone tried to, well, I think they tried to break in and steal her jewelry. But yeah, I think that definitely that quiet luxury is having a moment. And, you know, again, due to the internet, you know, we do kind of have this subconscious knowing of, like, let's use the Cartier Love bracelet. I think a lot of people know what that bracelet looks like. It's just a very simple gold band with almost a screw looking kind of component to it. And so that bracelet, I think, is around, you know, it could be anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000. And a lot of people wear that bracelet. And you kind of know when you look at that, it's like a statement of luxury without having to be so bold and so blingy.
I mean, I've certainly noticed that with anything from Van Cleef and Arpels. That's just like, okay, I get it. You got money. We're asking people about jewelry that's particularly meaningful to them. Carol is calling us from Calabasas. Carol, what is it for you?
Hi, Austin. My grandmother was fleeing the Nazis in the 1940s. My grandfather had already been taken away, and one of the very few pieces of jewelry she was able to save was a gold locket that he had given to his mistress, not to her, but to some other woman. And she saved it. My mother often wore it, and I have it now. I don't wear it very often, but it's a great story, so I love to tell it.
Wow, that's just incredible. Carol, who do you think it will go to after you?
Well, I only have a son, so I'm guessing my daughter-in-law or any, you know, I'm not really sure. I haven't thought that far ahead.
It's such a meaningful item. I just certainly think about keeping that in the family. Carol in Calabasas, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We're going to have to take a quick break here on Air Talk, but when we come back in 60 seconds, a good handful of people want to share a piece of jewelry that they have inherited, maybe from a family member, maybe from a close friend, and why it means so much to them. And if you'd like to share, 866-893-5722 is our number. We're back in 60 seconds. It's Air Talk here on LAS 89.3. I'm Austin Cross. We're talking about changes in the jewelry industry, but we're also asking you about a piece of jewelry that you have that means a lot to you. Maybe you inherited it from somebody very close to you. What is that piece? Why is it so important to you? And yeah, do you wear it? Do you just keep it so that it stays safe? 866-893-5722 is our number. Manu is calling from Los Feliz. Manu, what is it for you?
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Well, I remember as a very small young girl, my mother had these three-string most beautiful crystal necklace. And I had such an infatuation with them. But I also had no idea about special stones or anything like that. Well, in 2013, my mother handed those crystals to me. And I had the privilege of wearing them for the very first time on my first appearance on red carpet. And so my mother got to see me wear those crystals. And then later on, she passed soon after that. So now I hold those crystals really close to my heart. And since then, I've also gained an infatuation with all of these precious stones. I've become this obsessive collector of stones and gems.
Manu, that is so special. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm sure it meant a lot for your mother to see you wearing those as well. Thank you so much for calling us today. Giselle is calling us from Van Nuys. Gisella, what is it for you?
Well, it's my mom's gold watch. As a little kid, I used to love to, like all kids, play with my mom's jewelry. I did not know how valuable it was. And I broke it when I left it in the yard. The dogs got to it. My mother, I don't think she ever forgave me. But after she died, I, you know, took the watch. I had it fixed, the chain part of it. And I turned it into a hanging pendant for my daughter who has an Apple Watch. She has the heart measurement ring. So I thought a pendant. And I gave it to her a few years ago because, you know, unlike the experience with my mother, I wanted to be able to see her wear it. And I hope she's wearing it. She lives in New York, so I'm going to have to check up on her.
Ask her for a picture of it. Wow, that's so great that you were able to turn it into something that you could still pass down. That's Gisella in Van Nuys. Laura is calling us from Laguna Woods. Laura, what is the special piece of jewelry for you?
Hi. My special piece is a rose gold wide wedding band that belonged to my great-great-grandmother. Her name was Mary. My grandpa gave me the ring a long time ago. This ring is over 100 years old because it has her name inscribed, Mary, and her wedding date. That was 11/15/1886.
Wow. Just
and I remember in 1986 thinking, this is so wonderful that I'm still wearing this ring, and it's over 100 years old. And I wear it all the time.
You still
on
do.
My right ring finger.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's so incredible. It's well over 100 years old at this point. I'm trying to do math in my head, like 137 years. It's Laura in Laguna Woods. Thanks so much for being with us, Laura. Sandra is calling us from Mar Vista. I understand that your mother gave you a platinum and diamond ring when you were 16. Tell me about that, Sandra.
Well, and I have two things I'll tell you about. The platinum and diamond ring my mother gave to me when I was 16, she got it when she was 16 from her mother, and my grandmother got it from her mother when she was 16. So I don't have a daughter, but I do have a niece who's only 7 at the moment, but I think I could give it to her when she turned 16.
Sandra, thanks so much for
now, being there's
with...
one other piece of jewelry I forgot to mention.
Okay,
to
squeeze it in real quick, Sandra.
I have a gold watch on a long gold chain, and what you do is you wear the chain on your neck, pin the watch to your lapel, and it's made of rose gold. There's a cameo. It's just beautiful, and it gets passed down through the women in the family. So I have it now, but next it'll go to a different niece when I pass away.
Wow, pins on your lapel. I really have to look that up. That's such a fascinating piece of jewelry. Simon is calling from Bel Air. Simon, what's the special thing for you?
Yeah, well, my grandfather fought the First World War. He had a watch that he wore throughout the war. He was eventually gassed at the Ardennes. He fought the Somme and the Ardennes. And then when he came back from the war, he gave the watch to my father, who then gave it to me. I was a homeless guy for 2 or 3 years, and I sold the watch in order to get myself out of homelessness. And there isn't a day that goes by that I don't think about that watch or regret having to sell that watch. I know my grandfather would have been understanding of it, but it's the only piece of inheritance I ever had, because watches are a man's jewelry. So there isn't a day that goes by I think, well, I wonder what would happen if I was still wearing that watch on my wrist.
Simon, thanks for sharing that. Are you feeling more stable now in your living situation, really quickly?
Yeah, I mean, it was a dark time, and it was difficult. And in the end, I now live in Bel Air in Los Angeles, and I was homeless in a cold weather climate. But that watch I used to have to keep hidden on my person, because I was sleeping in doorways and stuff. So that watch was a link to a very difficult period in time. And sometimes I think jewelry is a memory, almost like a memory muscle.
Simon, we might have to leave it there, but I'm so glad you found your footing. Thank you for sharing your story. I'm Austin Cross. This is Air Talk. Have a wonderful day.